Welcome to the FPS podcast series. This is podcast number 62. I am joined today by Britt Biles, Rommel Bond Dickinson, and Tom Reynolds of HKA. My name is Todd Hatherly, and I'm the Director of Programming for Federal Publication Seminars, and we're a leader in federal government contract training and professional development for over 60 years. And every year, we provide training for thousands of businesses, federal agencies, and individuals on legal, regulatory, compliance, and accounting nuances found in the federal regulations through nationwide classroom, online, in-house sessions. These podcasts are just a small sampling of important content. As a contracting professional, you can expect from attending an FPS program. Whether it's in person or online, live or on demand, you cannot find another source with the breadth and depth of experience, knowledge, and content anywhere. So please visit us at fedpubseminars.com for more information. As I mentioned, I'm talking to Britt Biles and Tom Reynolds, and we're going to talk about the CARES Act and what its purpose. So welcome, Britt and Tom.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Todd.
Tell us a little bit about yourselves first, and then we'll get right into the materials.
I'm happy to kick it off. I'm Tom Reynolds. I'm a partner with HKA, which is a leading global consulting firm specializing in risk mitigation, dispute resolution, expert witness, and litigation support. I'm personally a partner here in Washington, D.C. in the government contracts practice, where I help support contractors who provide goods and services to the federal government navigate the complex regulatory landscape that goes with selling goods and services to the government. I have about 20 years of experience. My main focus areas are core government compliance issues, so costing FAR/CAS compliance, but then also helping contractors with respect to litigation support and dispute resolution. So with that, Britt, I'll turn it over to you.
Hi there, I'm Britt Biles. I'm a partner at Rommel Bond Dickinson in the Washington, D.C. office. We are a transatlantic Am Law 100 firm with full services for corporate and individual clients. My practice is focused on litigation and government investigations and enforcement. I served in various senior roles in the federal government, Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Office of White House Counsel. And most pertinent to this conversation, I was the general counsel of the Small Business Administration when it was implementing and administering the CARES Act, including the Paycheck Protection Program. So I have represented a number of individuals, lenders, borrowers, all manner of participants in those loan programs and in various investigations and litigation related to the CARES Act.
So that is the topic of today, is the CARES Act. And this goes back 4 or 5 years now, when we think about it, back to the PPPs. And so what was the CARES Act and its purpose?
Yeah, so Todd, I'm sure most of the folks listening are aware of the CARES Act at least a high level. But in terms of background, Congress enacted the CARES Act, as you mentioned, 4 years ago, back in 2020, to provide economic assistance for American workers, businesses, and industries at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the overarching objective was to help save workers and businesses, most notably through the, you referenced the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, and ultimately provided additional funding to businesses through loans and other means to enable them to continue paying their workers, even though many businesses were shut down or had extremely limited working hours during the initial stages of the COVID-19 pandemic.
And what was really interesting about the CARES Act is that parts of it were structured as a public-private partnership, as in the fact that they were government loans, but they were not being provided by government entities in the first instance, at least with respect to the Paycheck Protection Program. Private sector lenders from fintechs to traditional financial institutions were actually funding the loans, and then they were being guaranteed by the Small Business Administration at 100% level. And that's what has led to some of the nuances of the CARES Act and PPP and some of the investigations that are going on now.
Interesting. So what's the current status of fraud investigations related to the CARES Act?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Todd, because maybe asking yourself, you know, why are we talking about this now? It's 2024. It's been 4 years since the CARES Act was enacted. And for all intents and purposes, the pandemic is over at this point. But if you think about it from a cyclical perspective, we had all of these businesses seeking assistance through the CARES Act and the PPP, and there were certain bad actors out there who saw an opportunity to get free money, if you will. And when you consider all this happened in a very condensed time period, and Britt could probably speak to this in more detail, but I've heard things like 14 years of lending and 14 years. And now on the back end, we're seeing the audits and investigations that are uncovering fraudulent behavior in connection with this financial assistance. It's also important to note that it's not uncommon to see this type of lag play out when dealing with any type of contingency activity. It's similar to audits happening years after a significant natural disaster and money is given out, or even during a heightened period of geopolitical instability or wartime type actions. And again, Britt will probably get into more details on this in a few minutes, but we're seeing, and DOJ is investigating, a lot of issues around false certifications, misappropriation of funds, submission of false data, and the failure of certain institutions to reasonably evaluate the accuracy of certifications.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the time has passed since the pandemic. We're 4 years out and 4 years from the passage of the CARES Act. But Congress extended the statute of limitations for CARES Act related fraud to 10 years. So we're in the midst of a lot of these ongoing investigations, and they will be going on for quite some time. And interestingly, there are several different touch points along the way where government agencies of different varieties are looking into the loans that were made. You have the Small Business Administration looking into whether loans should be forgiven or whether the lender's guarantees should be purchased. So that's a phase of this. But then you also have the Department of Justice, this fraud section, looking into whether loans were properly obtained or properly given. So you might have a loan that was forgiven by the SBA go on to be investigated by DOJ. So there are multiple iterations in the life cycle of these loans, and we're very much in the thick of it and will be for some time.
And Britt, if you don't mind, you mentioned the statute of limitations increasing to 10 years. From a legal perspective, kind of when does that 10-year period start, and what do you kind of see as the implications of the statute of limitations increasing all the way up to 10 years?
Well, I think one obvious implication is that it rips in more potential actors, because the statute of limitations for bank fraud has always been 10 years, but the statute of limitations for wire fraud was less than that. And many of these PPP loans were made by non-traditional lenders. So they were fintechs and other non-banks. So the statute of limitations extension is particularly relevant for them. In terms of when the statute of limitations starts to run, there are a variety of things that can be triggers, and there are different arguments that people can make about when the trigger should be. I think the safest bet for people to think of is when they got the loan. When was it actually applied for or disbursed?
So DOJ is doing the investigations, and they have a role in this. But how is the USBA involved in the review, and to what extent are they using different techniques?
Sure. So there are several different entities involved. So there's the U.S. Small Business Administration, the agency itself, the agency that provided the 100% guarantees on these loans. Then there's the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Inspector General, which is performing an investigatory function. So those are two different streams within SBA that are performing different functions. So starting with the SBA itself, the agency that I was the general counsel of, the most immediate role of that agency is to review the loans when a borrower seeks forgiveness. These loans were conceived of as essentially grants where, if they were used improperly, the U.S. government would fund 100% of them, that the borrower would get the benefit of the money and never have to repay it. So the SBA reviews loans when it's going through the process of determining whether they should be forgiven. Some loans either don't get forgiven because they weren't used properly, the borrower never seeks forgiveness, or other circumstances arise that cause the lender to go to SBA and say, purchase my 100% guarantee I gave out this money. I'm not getting paid back by the borrower for whatever reason. So you, SBA, should pay me back. So those are two areas in which the SBA is looking at these loans to see, should they be forgiven or should the guarantees be purchased? In doing that, the SBA is undertaking extensive loan reviews, and they can review any loan at any time. And they're even going back and reviewing some loans that they have already forgiven because they find a reason to, or they're changing their criteria in some way. So there's really not a lot of respite in terms of borrowers and lenders with these loans. Even if they feel like they've got through one hurdle, the SBA has reserved its rights to go back and look at loans, sometimes multiple times. The way they're doing it is with very sophisticated data analytics and AI tools that they've contracted out through a third party. And those are teeing up red flags, if you will, and identifying particular issues that a loan might have. And then it goes on to a manual review process where a bunch of individuals who are contracted with the agency are taking a look at the loans and seeing if the loan was properly given, if the eligibility criteria were met, and things like that. So that's what the SBA is doing, and that's in the forgiveness stage and the guarantee purchase stage. The Office of Inspector General is a quasi-criminal agency that is working with the Department of Justice. So SBA's OIG investigates potential fraud, waste, and abuse. So they're looking at the data set for all the PPP loans and seeing what stands out to them. Like, are there common IP addresses associated with loans suggesting that there could be a fraud ring? That's an example of what they look at. The SBA OIG works very closely with the Department of Justice and makes criminal referrals and conducts investigations along with various other agencies within the government as well. So that's happening there. Separately, the Department of Justice is doing its own investigations, particularly under the False Claims Act. And that's where you could have a situation, and there have been cases like this, where SBA forgave a loan and then DOJ goes on and does a false claim investigation, and the borrower or lender ends up having to settle a false claims charge.
Interesting. So is that false claim coming out of a whistleblower or is it just investigation part?
It could be both. False Claims Act cases are traditionally brought by relators in key team actions. So there are definitely some of the cases that DOJ has been settling that you see coming through that means. But DOJ also has robust data sharing agreements with SBA and other government agencies. These are memos of understanding that were put in place during my time at SBA to ensure that the investigative authorities have access to the data. So DOJ is running its own data analytics and investigative tools across the loans as well.
What trends are emerging in the investigation of these lending institutions?
I could kick it off. One of the things that we're seeing is that there's investigations happening at both the financial institution level as well as the entity who received the loan. So, for example, financial institutions that may not have done their due diligence in initially evaluating the loan application are getting cited by DOJ and other investigative agencies in connection with the PPP loans that they gave out. And then naturally, as Britt has alluded to, a lot of these entities or businesses who are receiving the loans are also getting investigated for pretty much runs the gamut, but everything from falsifying their applications to issues when it comes time to apply for forgiveness of the loans.
And I think the biggest trend is a shift in focus. When the PPP was first put in place, there was a lot of quick and dirty criminal investigations of people who very obviously got loans that they didn't deserve and they used them for improper purposes. For example, people who bought Lamborghinis with PPP loans. Those were the headline grabbers. Those were things that were quick and easy to investigate, and those people were very quickly brought to justice. I think over the time period, as that period has passed, the focus has shifted more to more sophisticated analysis of the loans, and you have a harder look at lenders that are making the loans, and you have a harder look at borrowers who may have been legitimate businesses but may have not met the criteria in some way, or there could be a valid disagreement about whether the criteria was met. I mean, unfortunately, that's something that I am seeing a lot of with respect to lenders and borrowers. These programs were put into place. The regulations were drafted. Frequently asked questions were provided. People were given a basic roadmap to determine their eligibility. But when you're giving loans to a wide swath of the American economy, the eligibility criteria isn't going to fit everyone perfectly, and exactly what has to be looked at is up to reasonable interpretation sometimes. So I'm seeing a lot of situations where a borrower or a lender thought they were complying, or they had arguments to say they did something the right way, or they had arguments that they were eligible or the borrower was eligible. But then now, through the passage of time and Monday morning quarterbacking, there are others within the government who are looking at the facts and viewing them differently. So a lot of this is what I would characterize as good faith disputes about eligibility. There are more extreme cases with falsified documents and things like that, but a lot of it is just, this is what I thought I was supposed to do, this is what I did, and now someone is looking at it later and saying that I didn't do it the right way. And some of this also involves other complex regulatory schemes that were overlaid on top of the PPP program. Like the Bank Secrecy Act is an issue that has tripped up a lot of lenders, because they, especially the non-traditional ones, because they had to apply Bank Secrecy Act requirements in conjunction with underwriting PPP loans. So you see some investigations centered on that issue.
So there's intentional misconduct, but there's also really unintentional, if you will, in this whole thing.
So, gray areas.
Right, right. Which are coming down to the criminal. There's still both criminal and civil penalties. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Yeah. That really is focused on the level of intent that the government thinks that it can demonstrate. You have the gamut of people falsifying documents that show clear intent, and then you have more knowing or recklessness questions that come down to a fact-specific analysis of whether the government thinks it can prove a case that something was done intentionally or knowingly.
So what are the penalties for deceptiveness, and how do they increase?
Well, as you alluded to, I mean, there are criminal penalties that could be in play, and then there are various degrees of civil penalties that can be significantly larger than the loans that were actually given or received. For example, the False Claims Act has treble damages. So you see settlements even in relatively small cases where a financial institution realized, for example, that they didn't follow the Bank Secrecy Act, and then they settled a case with treble damages. So it was like three times the amount of the loans that they were giving out.
So what are some of the additional risks businesses should be concerned about going forward here?
Yeah, from my perspective, I think the biggest thing is that the audits are just getting started. And if you're a business or a financial institution, you know, don't think you're out of the woods at this point if you haven't been audited, because as Britt alluded to, there's a lot of initiatives out there and the investigators are using more sophisticated and advanced techniques. So again, it's very important to make sure you have all your documentation in order. And in terms of additional investigations coming down the pike, I mean, just as an example, within the last month or so, the White House indicated that it's working with Congress to secure about $1.3 billion to expand the government's ability to investigate this type of fraud. So again, just maintaining that awareness and making sure that documentation is in order.
And I would say, don't think you're out of the woods yet, because I think in reality, loans were made, loans were received at the time when the country was in an emergency situation. Now, after the cold, hard passage of time with clear-headedness, it may be the case that a borrower or financial institution sees that there could be issues with some of their practices. And I would encourage those borrowers and lenders to evaluate their risk and determine what actually may have happened, to do their own investigation and get in front of any issues that they could have with the government, because a lot of these programs do have voluntary self-disclosure regimes that can result in leniency and reduced penalties. And it's generally better to get in front of these issues and engage with the government as opposed to crossing your fingers and hoping the government doesn't show up. Because when the government shows up, the investigation is going to be brutal and thorough, and the risk and the penalties are going to be significant.
As far as documentation, well, actually, to start from the beginning, who is issuing the letter that says the loans that you received is being selected for review? Is that being issued by DOJ? Is it SBA? Who's sending that out?
It could be different entities depending on the purpose. Okay. So the traditional loan review process that's going on at SBA, borrowers get notice of that through lenders. So that can be a way that they know that the loan is being reviewed in conjunction with a forgiveness request or request for guarantee purchase. But it's also coming in different ways. There could be grand jury subpoenas being issued by DOJ that people may not immediately know about. A lot of these investigations are covert until the government decides to surface. Additionally, various other federal agencies have roles to play in this. Like the Federal Reserve, for instance, had a loan facility where lenders could pledge PPP loans that they had already made effectively as collateral to get more funds to make more PPP loans. So the Federal Reserve has been going back to lenders and saying, you need to repay this portion of the facility because the loans that you pledged have been found to be bad loans, or the guarantees have been denied by SBA, so you need to give us back the money. So there are lots of different ways that issues are arising with lots of different agencies.
So you get one of these letters, what should you do?
Well, I think you have to take it very seriously and engage counsel immediately, because it's not something to be taken lightly. And I think the important thing to remember is that you want to actively present your case. You want to actively present your version of events. You have to tell the story of why you made the loan or received the loan and you thought it was proper. It's not a case where you immediately have to disengage and assume they've got me. let me just pay back all of the money, because there are gray areas here, as I alluded to earlier. And there are circumstances where government agencies may be overreaching, they may be misinterpreting the regulations that were put in place at the time, or they may just not have a good understanding of the facts of a particular lender or borrower situation. So I think that's why it's important to do an investigation and engage with counsel, so the borrower or lender involved can present their version of events and come to some sort of a resolution with the government. But sitting around and waiting for the government to pounce is not a strategy that's going to minimize your liability.
Right. So just closing out, so what advice, Tom and Britt, do you have for loan recipients and financial institutions?
Yeah, from my perspective, I think Britt used a great expression a minute ago where the documentation needs to tell the story. So everything from the eligibility to receive the loans to how the loan proceeds were used, supporting the eligibility for repayment, relief, or a waiver of forgiveness, all of that's going to be hypercritical in this situation. And we all know this was a very chaotic time. And if the documentation isn't fully there, then it may be helpful to, while it's still somewhat fresh, prepare some type of memo to the file or some type of document that tells a story of what transpired back during this time. And then also, as Britt alluded to, I think being above ground, if you become aware that there was something that was done that was a little bit running contrary to what the requirements were, you're not hiding that and hoping the government doesn't show up, but you know, voluntarily disclose that and be proactive in that regard.
And I would just add, being proactive in your own defense. Oftentimes when when companies and individuals are faced with the strong arm of the federal government, they tend to isolate themselves or just give up. And there are many ways to successfully defend these investigations and enforcement actions, whether it's to minimize your liability or eliminate your liability under certain circumstances, but you have to be prepared to educate the government and the agencies involved and explain the positions that you were taking and why, and just educate them also, frankly, on why their interpretation may not square with what should have been the interpretation at the time.
10 years is a long time for a statute of limitations for something like this. Isn't that correct? I mean, usually 5 to 7 years?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think bank fraud has a 10-year statute of limitations. There are many different federal crimes that have longer periods to investigate. And I think the recognition here is that lots of loans were made across huge sectors of the economy that may have not previously had a lot of intersection with government agencies. These aren't going to regulated entities, for example. So the burden on the federal government to investigate and identify issues and bring the cases forward is such a burden that Congress recognized that the statute of limitations needed to be extended. But from the standpoint of the individual lenders and the borrowers, it is a long time. I think most of the lenders who are in the traditional financial space are probably used to this prolonged period of scrutiny, but it does instinctively feel like a long time. You're talking about a decade.
And companies got bought and sold all the time. So if you're in a situation where that company's no longer, you know, had taken out PP loans, and all of a sudden you get a letter and you didn't know that this organization, that just adds the complexity of a merger and acquisition opportunity, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's where not to beat the dead horse, but you know, maintaining that type of documentation is going to be critical in those types of circumstances, because you may have people shifting roles or no longer coming over to the new company. And it does get complicated in terms of how does that documentation transition from company A to company B. But again, the more of that you can have in place, the better off you're going to be if one of these investigations does occur.
And then relatedly, you raise another point. I mean, there are rules around changes in ownership for PPP recipients. And that tease up another thing that I think people have to be mindful of. If they received a PPP loan or they're a provider of PPP loans, they now have this intersection with the government that they may have not had before that opens them up to new potential regulations that they might not be thinking of. So there isn't just potential violations related to the core activity. There could be second order violations because they're now involved in these programs.
Tom and Britt, thank you for your time. Having time to do this podcast. And any last advice, or are we pretty much covered everything we need to cover?
I think we pretty much covered it.
Yeah, I think so. And thanks for having us and letting us put some modern day context around what feels like an old issue now.
Britt and Tom, if anybody wants to get a hold of you, how would they do so? And
yeah, sure. I can be reached at tomreynolds@hka.com. And my number is 571-213-6120.
I can be reached at through Womble Bond Dickinson at Britt.Biles@WBDUS.com. So that's Britt.Biles@WBDUS.com. And my number is 202-306-6937.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this program. If you want more information about other great programs, go visit us at fedpubseminars.com. Till next time, stay safe and read the FAR.